Hello. Welcome to another episode of CRT Sound System. I am here with Reese as always for another episode on the Commodore 64. This is episode 44. Reese, how are you?
I'm incredible. How are you, Tom?
I'm fantastic. And we've got a guest returning again with a fun little C64 playlist is Dave. Dave, how are you?
Hello, I have comma returned to reach into your comma minds and open the Commodore.
All right, cutting
Nice.
that.
Yeah, we'll keep doing it, don't worry.
yeah, so I suppose when you brought me initially with the first one, you also sort of had a couple of other playlists that you put together. You really went and did the legwork on this a good while back. And actually the Commodore 64 episode, the first one we did, is one of our most listened to episodes.
Well,
So I
no,
thought it'd
that's
be fun to
fantastic.
come back. Yeah, I thought it'd be fun to come back and cover it, because like the C64, I think we talked about it a lot, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about cover some of the same things again. But there's so much good music on it, and it's really hard to sort of to just pick one composer or one game or whatever and just sort of talk about that, because the thing with the C64, I think more than other consoles and other things like that, is that it was a scene. Like a punk scene or like an emo scene or like a hip hop scene or whatever you want to call it. Like, it was like its own little musical community.
Yeah,
And I find that
definitely.
really fascinating about it, like, because it was just there was a very sort of DIY aesthetic to the whole thing. Most of these people were just like bedroom programmers. A lot of them were literally fucking children while they were writing these songs
Yeah.
and like programming them. So like it's a really cool little scene to dig into.
Yeah, and if you like think about it in the ways of like the sort of pictures of the evolution of species, you know, with all the branching paths of how things evolved, the like console gamer and the Commodore gamer evolved from different organisms and like evolved parallel but stayed separate. Like they very much turned into different beasts because like you don't see much, if any, Commodore music on Overclocked Remix, but there is a fairly extensive site with all the Commodore music called remix.qd. And while all of OC Remix's stuff is sort of on YouTube, all the Commodore Remix stuff is like exclusively MP3 files that you download and play in browser or play in your own little thing. So it's like two very different communities that seem to have almost no overlap. So I sort of found that fascinating as well.
Yeah, it really is its own little ecosystem. It's very interesting.
Yeah, but when I sort of came up with the idea for a Commodore episode, I essentially came up with an episode that was just way, way too long that we could never do. So we sort of ended up splitting it up into a trilogy. So this is the Empire Strikes Back now. So we don't need the setup. Yeah.
This is the last Jedi of the trilogy. This is going to be the best one that makes the
Makes
Commodore
everyone
60
angry.
fans angriest. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, I don't want to fight with you guys about Star Wars on a podcast. But basically, yeah.
Myself and Dave have had our disagreements about the last.
So this is sort of more the like the vibing episode where we have a lot of music from a couple of composers, because the style we sort of ended up going with was just sort of composer by composer blocks. So we're very much sticking with that. So for this first block, you just heard Ocean Loader 3. And I thought for the Commodore episode, I started with Ocean Loader 5 because it just had to start with an ocean loader. It's like a rule. But that was composed by Jonathan Dunn, and you could say I done him dirty, or like in the fighting game community that I won and Jonathan dunned him, because we just played Ocean Loader 5 and then we moved on from him. So I sort of wanted to maybe fix that here. Not for Jonathan Dunn, sorry, Jonathan, but for Peter Clark, who composed Ocean Loader 3. So we're going to do a Peter Clark block here. But one thing I thought was interesting, this might be the only time I've ever seen this ever in the world of music, but this song you just heard, Ocean Loader 3, Ocean Loader 5 was kind of made as a parody plot twist version of the same song. If you go
Oh,
back to the
interesting.
previous Commodore episode, the start of both of the songs are identical. They're by different composers, but when the drop happens, they become different songs. So when Jonathan Dunn made Ocean Loader 5, it was kind of like a parody, because when you're loading up a Commodore game, you don't know what the loader music is. Yeah. So when it starts, you're like, oh, it's this one. I know this one. But you don't know what it's called because the internet doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But then once it gets into it, it changes and it's a different song and it just blows your mind. And to tie it back to the previous episode, that Ocean Loader, Ocean Loader 3, was the one that preceded Slap Fight. If you remember all of our conversations about Slap Fight in the previous episode and how I really wanted someone from Mexico to contact me to discuss Slap Fight, that has not happened. I am no wiser than the last time we spoke a year and a half ago. I am exactly as unintelligent as I was previously.
Well, you know, we have to have payoffs for the later episodes.
Yeah.
After the Return of the Jedi of the Commodore 64 episodes, then you're gonna get like a triumphant, you know, like I know everything about Slap Fight. I am the Slap Fight King of Mexico City. So just be patient.
Yeah. I am waiting for the Phantom Menace of Slap Fighting to contact me. So if you have both of the Commodore episodes loaded, listen to both of the Ocean Loader 3 and 5 from the start of each episode, and you'll see that one of them is a plot twist that goes in the opposite direction. I've never seen that anywhere else in music, where, you know, a song had a twist.
That's fun, yeah. I suppose you might want to actually explain what a loader is, just for somebody who hasn't maybe listened to the previous episode or who has forgotten. It is something that's sort of unique to sort of PCs even, and to Commodore specifically.
Yeah. So I don't know. Was it the Insane Clown Posse who said magnets? How do they work? But Commodore games were coded to magnetic tape, which was a very slow process. So I think the Commodore games, what did they take, like 5 or 6 minutes to load?
On a good day, if they loaded.
Yeah. While they were loading, if they loaded, because that wasn't guaranteed. You run a magnet over a magnetic tape, you get a blank tape. While they were loading, in a little bit of the memory, it would play a loader song. And just like a comic book guy downloading his image of Captain Janeway, it would pixel by pixel, left to right, up to down, load a really cool image of what the game definitely wasn't going to look like. But you
those
know
those images were so cool though.
They were
so
like
evocative.
I don't know, it's like the public and private key. Like, you sort of needed that image to have an idea of what the really bad graphics were trying to represent. You're like, oh, I'm a spaceship. I didn't, you know, I wasn't sure what this triangle was supposed to represent. I could have been a car. While the game was loading, you got to listen to these cool songs, and each different company had different songs. And by far, one of the biggest publishers of the day was Ocean, who are famous for Ocean Loaders 2 to 5. Ocean Loader 1 is kind of, you know, it's removed from the history books because it was apparently kind of a beta of Ocean Loader 1. But I didn't know any of this stuff back in the day, because I think I told you that, like, I didn't have enough games to know that there was only 5 Ocean Loaders. You know, I thought that, you know, Ocean Loader 2 was just the song before the game of Batman, the movie, the game.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was made specifically for that one. But no, they had a little library they used to roll out.
Mm.
And yeah, no, it was, they were some of the best songs on the Commodore, ironically, because while the loading is happening, it's not using the other sound channels for sound effects, or it's not using the runtime to render graphics. So they could sort of do much more complexity while nothing else was happening.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So you also mentioned the first block here as well is going to be Peter Clark stuff. So
Yes. We're having a Peter Clark block, with apologies to Jonathan Dunn, who didn't get a block.
So tell us a bit about Peter Clark, because I'm not familiar with him. I'm familiar with the people later in the episode, but I'm not familiar with Peter Clark.
Yeah, well, he's a British composer, as, again, the sort of regionality of the Commodore often tends to be, with the SNES and the Mega Drive, the NES and the Master System, a lot of sort of Japanese composers and stuff, whereas with the Commodore, we've lots of sort of European, British Isles-centered creators. So he's a British man born in 1958, you know, maybe working as a child, as many of these guys were. But it was said that he shared a room at Ocean with Martin Galway. They both worked for the same company. And when I was looking into him to try and figure out if he had sort of done enough things I recognized to make a block, looking at his sort of discography, once I saw Bubble Bobble, I was like, okay, this guy gets a block because I love Bubble Bobble.
Hell yeah.
It was one of Bubble Bobble gang right here. If anybody doesn't know what Bubble Bobble is, it's kind of a dead genre that I came to learn much later in life is known as a single screen kill 'em up.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're presented with a screen, there's you and there's maybe six enemies. And when you kill them, you progress to the second screen. And I think Bubble Bobble had like 100 levels. But like, I would sit down and play that game now. Like, that's an absolute classic.
It's 10,000%. I wasn't aware that that was a specific genre, but I'm so happy to know that. I'm just immediately just like, oh, you mean also like Snow Bros?
Snow Bros, like, yeah. That's the one
it's like
I always play.
Snow Bros, Pang, I think Bomb Jack. And then like way later on the DSiWare, a game called Magical Whip, which is like sort of the most Bubble Bobble DNA I've seen in a game that wasn't like Bubble Bobble. I love those kind of just like get as far as you can, all the arcade games. And also Bubble Bobble is responsible for like one of my most old man moments was when, Reese, are you familiar with the Cannes Film Festival?
I am.
Yeah. Well, in the off season for poor people, they have the Cannes Game Festival, which takes place in the winter when everything is closed. So I have gone over to that a couple of times with the local fighting game community from Dublin, and they have, you know, like Street Fighter, and, you know, I got to play pre-release Street Fighter Cross Tekken, pre-release Skullgirls, but they had an arcade. So I went to the arcade and I played Ghosts and Goblins and I played Bubble Bobble and I got the high scores in both. And I went back to my group of students who were like 5 or 6 years younger than me. And I was like, yeah, I got the high score in Bubble Bobble. And they were like, what are these words you are saying? These words make no sense to us. I was like,
are you having a stroke?
Classic game Bubble Bobble? They're like, yeah, are you having a stroke, Dave? What are you talking about?
So I mean, I feel like that's a failure of, was that a Namco game?
Originally, I believe, to not educate
people. Because would you have to understand what the plot of Bubble Bobble is? I forget what you're going after, but it's two players, two little
girlfriends,
dinosaurs.
Reads. Always girlfriends.
Always girlfriends, of course. Yeah. The only thing that matters. You're little dinosaurs that just spit bubbles, and you put the monsters in the bubbles, and then you fucking butt stomp them to end their terrible life, and then you move on to the next screen. And I feel like this is something that would resonate throughout society. Maybe that's why we haven't heard more about Bubble Bobble, CIA. Yeah. It's like, you can't talk about that. It's gonna be too powerful of a cultural image. Yeah. But actually, I extremely check out Bubble Bobble.
Yeah, definitely. I just had a memory, and maybe I'm remembering it wrong, Dave, but seeing as it was discussed on the Streets of Rage episode as well. So, you know, the way at the end of Streets of Rage, you have the thing where you have to fight the guy if you get there. You have to fight your partner if you get to the end.
Yes.
Is that something that also happens in Bubble Bobble? I seem to recall that being a thing in Bubble Bobble. I'm not sure, maybe not in the Commodore 64 version, but like,
I feel like that might be something that
was done in the arcade version at least.
I feel from the ethereal backgrounds of my memory, you might be right, but yeah. I don't want to be a man reading off of Wikipedia on a podcast. So I'm just going to put this down to memory.
Yeah.
I'm not decisively saying one way or the other.
But, yeah, it's just something came to the back of my mind there as you were talking, and I was like, is that a thing?
Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting was that Bob and Bob, the Bubble Bobble cute little dinosaurs, are not originally dinosaurs. They were human men who are only dinosaurs because they have been cursed by a wizard. So this wizard is like, I'm going to take away your girlfriends and I'm going to curse you with dinosaur bubble powers, like the means to get them back. I'm going to basically give you superpowers.
Yeah.
And in later games, they are turned back into humans in Rainbow Islands.
I love Rainbow Islands.
Like horrifying little Betty Boo men. But then in the Bubble Bobble sequels and Bust a Move, it's just like, whatever, they're dinosaurs. They were never men. Let's just ignore
that branching timeline. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's a fitting. That's quite a poetic ending, is that they're turned back into men and they say, no, we're actually dinosaurs. We choose to reject our humanity. And we're just going to have bubble-based fun as dinosaurs. That's what I would do.
Yeah, canonically, they go from dinosaurs with the power of bubbles to men with the power of rainbows. Mm-hmm. So we've two tracks from Bubble Bobble in this block, and then also from the rest of Peter Clark's sort of discography, I've pulled Denarius, which is just looked to me like a bog standard shoot 'em up.
Pretty standard shooter, yeah.
Yeah, space game. Has no in-game music. The Denarius song is only the loader, so they weren't able to pull the resources to have music while the game was running. And then the final one in his block was Double Take, which is a weird game where you appear to be an old man levitating himself in his pajamas with psychic powers to shoot things across screens and also solve puzzles. And the thing I love about it, the thing I love about it is if you look up any videos of Double Take, there's generally comments of people saying, I had no idea how to beat this as a kid. And there's a specific comment I found that was a guy saying, I looked up a guide on how to beat this and I couldn't beat this. And now I have watched your play-by-play tutorial of how to beat this, and I still don't understand what's going on. So, even by this, Commodore game standards, apparently this is incredibly obtuse.
These images are fucking inscrutable.
It looks like he's got like some kebabs on the left and the right side of the screen in one of these, and I don't know, it's a weird one.
I think there's pixelated items that you don't know what they are that you have to bring to other pixelated items that you also don't know what they are. So there's like point and click adventure logic at play while you're doing a shoot 'em up, being a man levitating in his pajamas.
Okay. This seems to be an adventure about an old man who has a two monitor setup. A very early two monitor setup. So I gotta give it credit there. Definitely looking forward.
this is what old men did before they had to go on Facebook to go insane.
Exactly. Before woke.
Yeah.
All right. So I suppose we'll jump into the next block of tracks anyway, and we'll come back and chat a bit. You've got the intro from Bubble Bobble. You've got the main theme from Bubble Bobble. You have the Denarius theme / loader. And then you have the Double Take theme. All right, thanks for that, Peter Clark. Yeah, it was the Bubba Bubba Main Theme is possibly the most iconic song we've played on the podcast so far.
Like,
it's so singular, and like, yeah, I wasn't familiar with this version of the game as such, but like, once I heard this, I was like, oh yeah, this is clearly a good port at the very least, because like, they got this right.
It was very faithful. Yeah. One thing, I played a lot of the Commodore version, and we were talking briefly on camera about like a weird eccentricity it had, where you had three lives, but you also had three continues. But when you lost your first set of three lives, you got an immediate game over. So the only way to continue was to have the second player be in the game. And that way, when you died, instead of going to game over, it went to the, you know, you have 10 seconds to continue countdown. And I always thought that was like a limitation of the Commodore hardware, and it was kind of stupid. And I would have two joysticks, you know, like the one good one I was playing on, and then like the bad one I had for, you know, whoever my friend was who was playing. And if I was playing it by myself, I'd like jump back and forth between the two joysticks to make sure I didn't die on the last life. But I found out later that is actually authentic to the original arcade hardware. It was, I think, specifically to promote co-op play. If you weren't playing with someone, you got an immediate game over and couldn't continue. And that also made it so that that was one of the only games that I could get further on if I had one of my sisters playing with me. And they were not gamers at all.
Yeah.
They didn't need to perform. They simply needed to exist. So I always got further with them. But I think the one limitation of the Commodore 64 version was that there was no randomness. Like on level 8, there's like an umbrella that appears that lets you skip 6 levels, and it will appear 100% of the time without fail. So there was some points I was playing it where I had to like intentionally decide to not skip levels so I could actually see the 6 levels that are normally skipped by that umbrella. Whereas I think in the arcade version, there's like it real time tracks your stats. And like the more you run, the more power-ups that increase your running speed appear. And the more you shoot bubbles, the more like bubble power-ups appear. So you could, on the arcade version, like real time manipulate what the RNG was going to be. But the Commodore was just completely set in stone.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, I suppose it probably didn't have enough memory to do the to do what the arcade machine was. Because my understanding was that arcade machine was pretty complex, like for the time. And actually now when you mentioned about them sort of encouraging co-op, I just remembered an anecdote that I heard, I think on I don't know if you listen to the Podukan podcast. It's like it's just a podcast by a couple of guys who own arcades, and they just talk about classic arcade machines. It's really good if you haven't listened to it. Shout out to those guys. But
I've never heard of it, but I will check it out now.
They mentioned on their episode on Bubble Bobble, if I'm remembering right, that like the original design for this was like the point was to encourage like girlfriends who were just sort of in the arcades with their boyfriends, and their boyfriends were just playing games without them, to like to come and play the games with their boyfriends.
Basically, that's pretty clever.
Like, encourage that sort of co-op play.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And also makes sense with the art style, because everything is very cute.
Yeah.
Other than the like zombified wraith of a dead whale that comes to kill you if you take too long, everything is very cute.
Two player stuff, I know it primarily from the Nintendo. And so for me, primarily the two player stuff was taking turns. Not every game, but I would say the majority.
Yeah.
And it would always just be like, I'm so fucking bored here as Luigi. you know, like I wish Mario would die. And so, you know, that sort of circumnavigating it. So I loved whenever a friend was over, like Bubble Bobble would always be what I would gravitate to. And that main theme, oh my God, I've listened to it so fucking much in my life. That was a great version of it. I just want to add my two cents as well, that I was transported, you know, in over here in Reese's vision. I had the like the wavy camera effect and just
get the Kill Bill siren going off.
Yeah, exactly.
One minor optimization I just remembered while Reese was talking there was that in the arcade version, when you transitioned screens, your dinosaur was reset to the bottom left where you start each screen from. Whereas in the Commodore version, wherever you are in the screen, when it transitions to the new one, you are where you were on the previous screen, and then your dinosaur slowly moves down in the bubble to the bottom left. and then pops and lets you out. So an optimization in the Commodore version that wasn't in the other ones is that once you beat the level and got all the fruit, try and get back down to the bottom left of the screen so you're not waiting as long when the screen goes over to move back.
Oh, nice, nice. That often happens with transitions as you become a left bottom. So
yeah. I was obviously very concerned about my time as a small child waiting 15 minutes for a magnetic tape to load.
Oh God, I'm not going to pass comment on that joke, Reese.
good.
Jesus Christ. All right, so I think it's time to talk about Tim Fallon. We
yes.
somehow managed to go through the entire last episode without having any Tim Fallon tracks. Previous to this, we've only had him on one episode, maybe two before. So I think it's probably time to fucking talk about one of the goats. One of the fucking best to ever do it, Tim fucking Fallon.
I didn't, because the previous episode was sort of more of like a sample set. There's like lots of songs from lots of different games. I didn't want to introduce Tim Fallon until we sort of had a lot of time to talk about him and listen to him and just give him a big block of tracks for himself.
Yeah.
And I did have people ask me when the first Commodore episode came out, I was like, oh, how much Tim Fallon was in your episode? And I was like, oh, actually none. We're saving him. We're saving him for another one.
Yeah. So we've got a bunch of tracks from Ghouls and Ghosts and then some from Bionic Commando. But yeah, like... Funnily enough, actually, to go back to the Streets of Rage episode, remember literally after we recorded it, Charles Cornell had that episode, or had one of his episodes about video game music, about Streets of Rage that you posted into the channel, or I posted into the channel.
He recently
did one about Tim Fallon as well, more on his sort of NES stuff, so like the Pictionary track, Pictionary soundtrack, which we have played on a previous episode, and the Solstice soundtrack, which are absolute fucking bangers. But yeah, he sort of started off in the Commodore 64 scene, and again, as more or less a child, sort of doing this, and sort of some sort of magician with with music somehow. Yeah. He just like, yeah.
Can I have a wildly potentially unhinged theory about Tim Fallon?
Go ahead.
Please. Yeah,
take this with a grain of salt, listener, because or more than a grain of salt. Assume outright that I am lying. Because I don't know Tim Fallon, and all of the information I have gathered is from wikis who could have been edited by Hitler. I don't know. But he strikes me as a super bored genius.
Yeah.
And a specific kind of genius. I don't know, do they have a word for the term? But sort of like sibling skill mitosis absorption or something, where he had two older brothers, Mike and Jeff, who were also composing music for video games.
Mm-hmm.
And he was around them as the youngest, and he seemed to just sort of absorb all of their skills and just like Voltron into the best version of them. We've sort of seen this as well in the fighting game community with Sonic Fox, who grew up with an older brother who was like a world champion level Dead or Alive player.
Oh,
and Sonic
Fox,
he was playing with, you know, top 1% talent in his like sitting room at home. And just basically became someone who was able to beat anyone in any game if they were bothered to pick it up. So I think Tim Fallon sort of just absorbed all of his brother's powers. And from reading about him, he doesn't seem to be very into video games and just sort of produced tracks in a very workman way, whether or not they fit the game. And I think the prime one, as you mentioned, is Pictionary, which is the most unnecessarily banging track that should ever exist. It's not going to be in this episode because it's for the NES game.
Yeah, it is in our previous episode on licensed games that have music way better than it should have.
Yeah.
But I think he has gone on record, and again, this could be someone making stuff up, saying that he's not a fan of his own video game work, with the exception of the Ghouls and Ghosts soundtrack, which we're going to play. And when you're listening to it, like, this isn't just a soundtrack. Like, the first track in this list is like a soundscape. He went and like made ambient horror noises. He figured out how to make rain effects with the Commodore SID chip. It sounds wonderful. So I think he was maybe excited by this challenge, and it sort of lulled him out of his genius stupor long enough to have a modicum of enjoyment. And again,
that's exciting.
I might be making all of this up. Don't believe anything you hear.
No, it's true. It's true.
It's true. It's 100% true.
Yeah, edit that out.
You can put it.
Quote me on a different wiki page so that this all creates a circle of fact.
Exactly.
Impenetrable. Yeah. I know you are a big fan of Ghouls and Ghosts, Dave. Have you played the C64 version? Is that sort of one you played?
Yes, I own it. I still have the cassette.
Still have it. Oh, geez.
I had 200 Commodore 64 games, and I think I only beat two. This was one of them, and only because it was a very late era Commodore thing, and they were getting into the habit of putting in cheats. So if you play Ghouls and Ghosts and you die, and you put your name on the high scoreboard as Wigan or LFC, you can have infinite lives and level skip. That is presumably the name of the local football club.
That is Wigan Rugby League Football Club. Yeah, so that's
okay.
Yeah,
I would have thought it was Royal League rather than Rugby.
No, it's the Rugby League team from Wigan, and yeah, it makes sense with the Follins being from St. Helens, so they're from that part of the world. Yeah,
perfect. I didn't look that up. I swear to God, I remember it. And we with those cheats, I did beat that game. And it's one of only, I can't remember what the second one is. It was probably a very short game, or if it's something silly like Commando that just loops infinitely. So yeah, this is a really good port, very enjoyable, very arcade accurate, and just amazing soundtrack. But what we're going to go through is this and Bionic Commando, which I haven't played, but does have a great soundtrack. And then at the very end, there's Agent X2, the first level. I tried to find Agent X1, but it looks like that was a Spectrum game only. Wasn't released on any other platforms. And Spectrum music seems to be single sound channels. So a lot of it, no offense, Spectrum fans, isn't very good.
It is very basic on Spectrum stuff. Like, there's some good tunes on it, but like, it is much more basic because.
Yeah.
The
Agent X music is just the last little palate cleanser of this big block of Tim Follin music.
Well, I've actually split this into two blocks, I think, have I? No, I haven't. Okay. So yeah, this is going to be a big, big, long one. Okay. Sorry. I thought that we had this
Tom is for some reason. Willingly dancing on the puppet strings I have set out for him.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, this is possibly the longest block we'll ever have. We've got what? Seven tracks from Ghouls and Ghosts. So the intro, stages 1 through 5 as 5 separate tracks, then the high score screen. Then from Bionic Commando, we've got the title, we've got stage 1 through 5 again. And then we have the high scores screen for Bionic Commando. And then the last track on that is Agent X.
Yeah. I think around the point you hear a really cool steel drum solo, we have officially transitioned from Ghouls and Ghosts to Bionic Commando.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Some of that was absolute badness.
So many cool things. Yeah. Agent X, if anybody hasn't seen it, I assume nobody has, because I hadn't before I looked this up, is a very typical 8-bit microcomputer game where like level 1 is a platformer and then level 2 is a driving game and then level 3 is Breakout. You never spend very long with any game mechanic. It just randomly flits around the place.
Very cool. Yeah, that track was very good. You were saying as well, that's more or less the only thing that's sort of notable about the soundtrack is that one track, which was really, really good.
Yeah, it was very hard to find out anything about the game because I think it was a sequel to a game that was exclusive to the Spectrum.
Mm.
And I don't believe the game itself is very highly noted. It's only, you know, the magical finger descending from heaven of Tim Fallon that gives it any sort of notoriety.
Yeah.
But, just kind of realizing as we were going through this that yet again in a episode exclusively about the Commodore 64, Capcom has raised its fairly sizable head because both Bionic Commando and Ghouls and Ghosts are Capcom games.
They were
giant noggin.
Yeah, and we began the first one with Commando, which again is another Capcom joint. So they've been at it a while, and I'm here singing their praises decades later.
Yeah, it's always an interesting thing, I think. Yeah, with those when those games were sort of being ported over, because like almost none of them would have been done in house by Capcom at the time, so they were just like farmed out to whoever. So like the quality of any given port could be, it was a real coin toss.
Oh yeah, it was crazy. If you want like the worst horror Capcom cash in. Look at the Commodore 64 port of Street Fighter 2.
Oh, Jesus, like, yeah.
You can just imagine a bunch of executives going, quickly, we need to make money. We must release this. It doesn't matter how bad it is.
Yeah.
I think the music for the Commodore version of Street Fighter 2, you know the character select theme?
Yeah.
It's just an 8-bit version of that for the whole game. There's no individual level themes versus music, anything like that. It's brutal. But these ports, well, Ghouls and Ghosts anyway, I thought was excellent. I haven't played Bionic Commando, but that also looks pretty solid. Yeah. And this episode just unlocked like a huge core memory for me that like one of my earliest gaming experiences was my elder sister taking me to a local pub, which had two arcade games. Do you remember the old cabinets that were glass top tables in pubs?
Cocktail cabinets, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
The local pub had two cabinets. One was Bubble Bobble and one was Ghosts and Goblins, the prequel to Ghouls and Ghosts. And whenever we went in, she would put money in the jukebox and play Love Shack by the B-52s. So I have a very strong memory of playing both of these games to the tune of Love Shack. And I remember once the man came to take the money out of the arcade machine for Bubble Bobble and showed me that inside the machine, there's a button that the coin hits as it falls down that gives you a credit. So he showed me the button being pressed and then went to the bar with the takings. And as soon as he was out of sight, I was mashing on that button like I was playing Cookie Clicker to try and get as many dozens or hundreds of credits as I could to play Bubble Bobble. Because I was a tiny, stupid child, I still could not beat the game, even with functionally infinite credits.
Oh, dear. I wonder if the man knew what he was doing. He was just like, I'm just going to show this kid.
Yeah, I think he was maybe friends with my sister. I thought I was conning. Okay. I was conning someone, and I was conning nobody.
I mean, yeah. it's such a weird thing of like, just going to being in a bar as a child in the 80s. Like, yeah. I don't know if that was something your parents did, Reese, but like just bringing you to a pub. Or to a local bar and just sort of drinking while you're just sort of there trying to make your own fun. Yeah.
No, not that necessarily, but I was left alone, perhaps too much. And so I would just like wander into bars at like 1 p.m. and just like go to the arcade, and they were just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And so that's kind of like my experience is just like, finding there's a couple bars they had like, you know, Centipede or something. And so it's not quite the same. My parents did not enjoy bars.
That's where I got a lot
in Ireland, in rural Ireland in particular, and the same in where Dave grew up is slightly less rural, but like the bar is where you just went to socialize. Like that's where everybody was. So like, mm-hmm. There wasn't really anywhere else to go for people if they just wanted to like just go out for an evening. And like, I genuinely have so many formative memories that took place in local bars.
Yeah, where I was like... in the late 80s, early 90s, all we had in Ireland were Catholic guilt and drinking problems.
First one and then the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, because the one thing, just another random memory a lot is like specifically the first Italian World Cup that Ireland got to in the soccer. So it was like Italian 90 was the first World Cup. I remember going down to the local pub, down to Bones in Dingle, for anybody who wants to go there, it's still open. going down to Bones in Dingle and just sitting in the back room there. But also like in between matches, we would like, cause, I don't know if this is really a thing, in bars in the States, Reese, but like, most of the time, if you're in a bar, it's also somebody's house. so like, you know, you'd go to a back room or you go upstairs and that's where like the publicans would actually live. They'd live in the bars. So like I had friends whose parents had bars and stuff like that. So like if we would go to these bars, oftentimes it would just be like my parents would drink with their friends in the front, and then we just go to the back room or upstairs. And like I remember like watching Italia 90 and playing on my friend Brian's Game Boy and beating Super Mario 2. Mario Land 2 on the Game Boy while watching the soccer on his TV. So that's nice. Yeah, just a random memory, but like, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I think when we were qualifying in Italia 90 and playing the important matches, I was staying with my parents on a little caravan by the beach they had rented.
Oh, okay.
And I had a loan of my friend's Sega Mega Drive, which I did not own. And I did not want to watch the football. I wanted to change the channel and play my Mega Drive, but I was not permitted. I was not allowed to play Sonic 1 or 2 for arguably the most important sporting event in Irish history. And I was not happy. So I left that caravan and I went for a walk because I wasn't going to watch that crap.
So let me ask you maybe a strange question. If you're a kid and you're playing... you know, Game Boy in upstairs or in the back room. Was there occasionally just like bar patrons just bursting in and just being like, oh, oops, sorry.
Not really, no, because like with the size of a town like Dingle, like everybody knew everybody. So like anybody who was going to be in there knew that they were going to be in there for a reason or they didn't go in there, you know?
Okay, that's fair. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Great, great. They like echoes of fate and destiny. In Dingle, you are where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, very much so.
I gotta visit Dingle. I've been yearning for that feeling.
Oh, it's very nice. You should.
Dingle is lovely, yeah. Yeah, so I think we're gonna talk about another legend, I think, next. So the next block you have is the you've titled the Chris Hulls block. Chris Hulsbeck or Hulsbeck, I'm not quite sure. We had some tracks from the Great Guiana Sisters, I think, in the last one.
Yes, we did.
That was him. And now we've got some tracks from Turrican. I fucking love this one. This is such a cool soundtrack.
I had to bring him back because I feel in a little way I did him dirty because I, not quite like Jonathan Dunn, but I had him in the copyright infringement block, which was just discussing how the Guiana Sisters was just a total ripoff of the Mario Brothers. But yeah. That Chris Hulsbeck didn't, he had nothing to do with that. He just made the music.
Yeah.
So he's a German composer. I have his full name written down here as Christopher Frederick Martin Hulsbeck. So yeah, again, keeping to the sort of Eurocentric theme of the Commodore, he is German. And yeah, Turrican's a cool game. This was very, very formative for me because there's not a lot of tracks here, but you'll be able to see it in the podcast notes that one of these tracks is called Going Up. And I have a very specific memory of this because around level 2 or 3, you fight your way through. It's kind of Metroid-y. It's like a run and gun, but it was like weirdly open world in a way the Commodore games are never usually. They're usually very set levels. So you can kind of explore. And my memories of both Turrican 1 and Turrican 2 is just sort of playing it for a while, getting lost, not knowing where to go, getting frustrated and stopping.
Yeah.
You know, very rarely did I sort of get through the game. But around level 2 or 3, you kill your way to the end and there's a jetpack just sat there. And when you get the jetpack, music starts up where music hadn't been before. And the level turns into a vertical shooter when you're shooting things with your jetpack. And I loved that music from that section of Turrican, but I didn't own Turrican. I borrowed it from a friend. And it was a real like pressing need in my tiny mind to be like, I'm going to need to give this game back to my friend, but I don't want to not be able to listen to the jetpack music from Turrican. So yeah. I started recording music off of Commodore 64 games onto cassette tapes.
Mm. And hell that yes. Oh.
Absolutely formed my love of video game music that basically brings me to you now. We have come a complete circle. But those were also recorded on magnetic cassette tape, you know, the most hardy of all formats. And I still have those to this day, little tiny 8 to 10 year old me doing little DJ narrations between playing songs. But it started with Turrican just very because cool. of the limited nature, the scarcity of this music. I had to give it back, so I didn't want to keep the game, but I needed to keep the music.
Very and cool.
As with every episode I'm on, we have to go straight to Yuzo Koshiro. There was a Mega Drive port of this game and he did some original tracks for that.
Yeah.
We're not going to feature them, but I got to mention the master.
Absolutely. Well, I'm gonna mention him again myself. So Chris Hulsbeck has a Bandcamp, which you should all check out. There's so much music on it.
I think he also has a Patreon in my notes.
I believe so, yeah. But he has like rearranged and updated versions of a lot of his soundtracks. But one thing that he also has is it's called the Final Fight TSA. There's two separate Yuzo Koshiro remixes of the final battle theme from Turrican on his Bandcamp. They're also on Spotify. Absolutely fucking check them out. They're so, so good.
I'd love to check. Please put those in the show notes.
I will put links to them in the show notes. They're so good. They're like some of my favorite like video game tracks ever. Like just two of the fucking best to ever do it working together like that, and it sounds so good. The other thing I wanted to mention is I only ever played the Game Boy version of this game, which was not called Turrican. It was rebranded as a Universal Soldier tie-in game.
Oh my god, I didn't know that.
So there's
that's,
a game
that's fascinating.
This game was just like redone, just reskinned on Game Boy and titled Universal Soldier. And like the first boss is replaced with like a giant Dolph Lundgren head or some shit.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so that's my sort of my main experience with Turrican outside of it. But I also have an analog Super NT, which comes built in with Turrican 1 and Turrican 2, like expanded versions of that game. On the analog Super NT, I've played both games since then, and they still hold up really, really well. It's a very, very cool game.
I can remember one section you go underwater and you fight a giant, I think, anglerfish. One of the only specific moments I can remember. One other thing I wanted to bring up, very often in the bits between the songs where we're just talking and it doesn't make the podcast, we do discuss when songs are inspired by other songs, but generally speaking, because this is such a deep rabbit hole, we don't talk about it in the parts you hear. But I think we have to make an exception for this bit.
Okay.
Because I mentioned how it was unfair to unfairly tar Chris Hulsbeck with the copyright infringement brush on the previous episode. Yeah. So I'm going to fairly tar him with the brush in this episode, because for whatever reason, two of the tracks from Turrican are rips from Transformers the movie.
Yes.
If you're going to rip anything.
From the longest time, the last boss music and all of the things I was listening to, the alternate name of it is The Death of Optimus Prime. And I thought, well, you know, back in the early days of the Commodore, copyright didn't exist. Everybody, you know, ripped off everybody else. It was conceivable to me that the last boss of Turrican would be Optimus Prime and you'd kill him and that would be the end of the game. But it's like a jazzier dance version of the sad music for when, spoilers, Optimus Prime dies in that film. I think it came out in 1984.
On his Bandcamp page, on one of the Turrican ones, there is a couple of tracks by Vince DiCola.
Yes.
So I think he eventually sort of worked with him to actually put these tracks to them.
Yeah, it seems like this was all resolved very amicably, because I think in re-releases of Turrican, the tracks that are the Transformers music are replaced by different ones. But then the composer of the Transformers music, who you just mentioned, did supply new original music. So everybody's cool with it. And I sort of resolved to never talk about what music rips off other music. Because in the world of Commodore, like it's piracy and freebooting all the way down. But in this specific case, I wanted to mention it because it's such a very strange and very specific pull that it's from the movie of the cartoon about the toys that is there to sell toys.
Very cool. Yeah, so we'll jump into this last block of tracks then. All of these are from the first Turrican. So we have just Turrican main theme, then the track you mentioned going up. We have in-game 4 and in-game 3, and then lastly we have ending.
Awesome.
Right. So I'm gonna let Chris Hulsbeck off the hook here a bit. So that last track you mentioned was stolen, let's say, from Optimus, the death of Optimus Prime from the Transformers movies. So from what I can see here, Chris Hulsbeck was not responsible for either of the two tracks that were ripped off from that. So listed on the download that I have is another composer. Let me just double check here, by the name of Rami Rovaca. And apparently he was the one who copied the two songs from the Transformers movie and copied them over into the C64. So the other song is Subsong 2, which was taken from the song Escape, and then this track, the last track of the ending theme, was from The Death of Optimus Prime. So so Chris Hulsbeck is officially on the hook, I think.
I am horrified any malignant person would ever dare accuse Chris Hulsbeck of doing anything untoward. And I would also like to say that I prefaced all of this by saying, believe nothing I say, because I'm reading this off of wikis. And
yeah.
This could be edited by anybody.
And a lot of this stuff is very sort of, it's very hard to find concrete information on. Yeah. And it's something we run into a lot, where like, who exactly composed what can sometimes be completely unknown or obfuscated in some way, oftentimes yes. deliberately by the people who are doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, just it makes our life difficult sometimes.
Wrong on purpose. It's really the full gamut of
but even though they are stolen, like, as listeners, that doesn't really matter. They sound great. And
yeah.
also, as we were discussing, like, the death of Optimus Prime in the movie is quite a sad, downbeat
yeah.
track, because, you know, presumably someone cares that Optimus Prime died. But the game version is like super jazzy and dancey yeah. and very exciting. So it was a real weird decision to take that one, but I love what they did with it. It's fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, as we said, legally, everybody seems to be very happy with how it all turned out. So there's
yeah.
no bad blood anywhere. Hopefully not between me and Chris Hulsbeck now.
Well, he is on Twitter, so maybe.
Well, I'm not, so he can't find me. Ha ha ha.
I won't tag him in the episode in the drops. But yeah, no, it's cool, and like, it's something I do love, and I feel like this is a complete and utter tangent. But I often complain about it, like, musical traditions are often about just sort of stealing stuff or just like repurposing old things, and like in the past, like, doing that was actually about paying your dues to the people that sort of came before you, and sort of paying tribute to them, whereas now it's seen as like plagiarism and seen as like being this big deal that you're sort of you've taken a song you like and sort of repurposed it for something you want, and it's seen as sort of anti-creative. But like, that's only really because of capitalism in the last sort of 100 years. Yeah. Like previous to that, like, the tradition of music and the tradition of like folk songs and blues and jazz and everything was about sort of you learned these songs. You had to fucking like part of coming up as a musician was that you had to learn these standards and learn, you know, what came before you, because you needed that sort of you needed to be able to pay tribute as you sort of went ahead. And like, I feel like that's something we've lost. And it's something I love to sort of explore. When, like, one episode I really want to do down the line is sort of just stolen music.
Yeah.
And music that's sort of come, and, you know, where people have just taken a song they like and just found a little sample or something like that and just built a completely different thing out of it. And I love that shit. And yeah, it's just, it's very cool. It's like, as you say, like, the version of Death of Optimus Prime that you hear on this soundtrack is so different to what you'd hear on the Transformers soundtrack that it might as well be a different song.
Yeah. And I think cool. It's so funny that, like, I thought for so long that you did just kill Optimus Prime at the end of the game. I never even looked into it until we were recording our last episode. I was like, oh, wait, no, this is an entirely different thing. What's happening here? I thought this was going to be like the Revenge of Shinobi, where like you kill Spider-Man, Batman, the Terminator and Godzilla until everybody's lawyers get involved. And then all of those elements are removed from the game.
Yeah.
But if you go to, with every episode I'm on, I do a little, sorry, I dropped a pipe there. I do a little WordPress about the songs. And for the previous Commodore episode, I think I was able to find for every single track what it was inspired by. But it's not ever something really going to talk about on the episode, because, you know, doing that on a song-by-song basis, I think, is very uninteresting.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoy it because in almost every case, it means I get two versions of a song I like that, you know, sort of appeal to different parts of my brain. Yeah. And some of the Rob Hubbard ones are like, he did versions of like 1920s license-free radio music that they played over dramas and stuff. There's some cool stuff there if you want to go back to the previous episode and the WordPress about it. But yeah, generally, I think I'm in favor of copyright infringement. I would never want to be someone who is on Twitter defending Nintendo.
I think that is absolutely,
I don't want to cast aspersions, but if you have ever done that, you're a bad person, and I don't want to be your friend.
Just based on what you said before, Tom, I just an image came to my head unbidden of just a museum like 600 years in the future, and that you could press a button to play the death of Optimus Prime, and they're just like an ancient American folk song covered endlessly. Anyways.
We'll probably wrap it up now, I think. Anyway, we're coming up on 2 hours, so the last track we have is an OC remix track, so we'll talk about that in a little bit anyway. But aside from your WordPress, Dave, do you have anything you want to plug?
No, never. No. Yeah, don't find me. I don't want to be found.
If you want to come, you can talk to Dave in the Discord. He usually hangs out there pretty often. So.
Oh, that is true. I can actually easily be found. Never mind.
And if you're Mexican and you played, what was the game? What was the Mexican
slap fight? Please slap tell fight. Me about slap
Please
fight.
Come and Mexican tell us about it.
I am left unfulfilled.
So Reese, what do you got going on at the moment?
Reese V Ryder on Twitter, on Blue Sky, on Twitch. I've been trying to stream a fair bit lately. Been doing all of the Souls likes. You can find my podcast Existential Warfare, releasing a single episode a year at Existential Warfare wherever you search your podcasts. And Video Games Are the Worst Thing on Earth, where we are just deeply embittered and filled with rage about politics and video games.
Absolutely. I will be on an upcoming episode of that as well, is worth mentioning.
Can't wait for that one.
One where we're getting angry about a number of different things.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
I'm subscribed to that podcast, Reese, so I'm looking forward to that episode.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah. If anybody wants to do any sort of Commodore 64 related research in between these episodes we release like every year and a half, a bunch of resources that I found very useful is a remix.quid, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And the guy who runs that website, Jan Lud Thompson, also has a podcast called the C64 Takeaway. It's one of, I think, the earliest podcasts in recorded memory, because I think he started it in like the early 2000s. These days, I think he just does one episode a year. But that's, if you want the air quotes Commodore news, any website or anything he brings up on those podcasts are long dead and gone. There's also the Immortal C64 podcast, which just is a lot of Commodore music, no talking. It's a good resource if you just want to leave it on in the background and then go, oh, what's that? Although their timestamps are terrible, so it can still be hard to figure out what they're talking about. Yeah. And Sprite Castle by Rob Flack O'Hare is a podcast where he goes Commodore game by Commodore game, just talking about the individual games and about the gameplay and the sort of history. And that's where I learned more about Commando. So there's a weird little subset of Commodore culture that's still ongoing. And the thing that made me do a huge double take was when this track we're going to finish with came up on an episode of the C64 Takeaway, because I know this from OC Remix, and to go super old man on it, back in the early days when I had like burned CDRs of all the overclocked remix music, I had this track on a mini disc, an extinct defunct Sony format. So just having the very separate circles of OC Remix and Commodore music like briefly have a little Venn diagram overlap made me very happy, and I think it's an excellent track. So I'm glad Tom let me do a remix as our finishing one rather than pure in-game music. So thank you for that, Tom.
No, that's good. I mean, this was your playlist. I do still have some of my old mini discs. I remember it was a weird moment, I think, where all of us got really into mini discs for a while.
Yeah,
we all bought mini discs.
Super
into mini discs were great.
Yeah,
They still are great, Reese. I still
Yeah, they're just it's a format that I think needs to come back. They were absolutely great.
I still have my Discman, my mini Discman, and all the mixes I made.
Oh, nice.
And so I agree. I listened to it and was just like transported to the 1,000 bus trips I took in college.
I made a beautiful mini disc of purely Final Fantasy music, and it was the most expertly playlisted thing ever. And I lost it, and I'm sad, and I never found it.
Oh my god!
So I don't know what was on it. I don't remember.
That's disappointing.
If anybody in Mexico has found that playlist,
please do. Let Dave know. Send it to me on Discord.
Cool. One C64 link that I would recommend people find as well is c64audio.com. So they have a lot, and I've drawn a lot of stuff for these episodes from there. A lot of sort of remastered versions of C64 music and sort of really high quality hardware recordings and things like that that can be got there, both paid and for free. So there's a bunch of stuff on there. So if there was stuff you liked on here, definitely go here. Go to Chris Hilsbeck's Bandcamp. There's a bunch of shit on that that's really, really cool.
Yes, one thing I did forget to mention is that there is a archive of C64 music called the HVSC. I forget what that stands for. I'm sorry. But it's basically a list of all of the Commodore tracks, but also all of the tracks people have made in the meantime since the sort of death of the Commodore. They're still fan composing music in the SID chips for fun that aren't tied to any games. But yeah. I think that archive is like 56,000 tracks.
It's big. That's where I got a lot of these from, is that archive.
Yeah. Because it's just executing Commodore 64 code, which is tiny. Like the entire 56-track archive is only about 400 megs.
It's quite small.
So you do need a unique player to play it. I use SID Play 3, but that's a fantastic thing to have if you just want a ton of music to take up a very small amount of space.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'll include links to all that in the show notes. Yeah. And as for ourselves, we can be found on Patreon. We're CRT Sound System there. We can be found on Discord. Come join our Discord if you're Mexican. If you're not Mexican, come join our Discord anyway. And yeah, just come and hang out. We're on Blue Sky and Twitter. CRT Sound System on Blue Sky, and we're CRT Pod System on Twitter. Send me an email, crtpodsystem@gmail.com. Come on the show if you want to come on the show. That would be fun. I'm always willing to hear people out on whatever soundtrack they want to come and do. Or if you have a weird playlist idea, send it over to me. I'm down for whatever.
I absolutely love it when just like a stranger reaches out and they're just like, I want to do this fucking PlayStation game. And we're just like, we've never heard of this. Let's do this.
Yeah, that's how a couple of episodes have come together, where somebody's just DM me on Twitter and be like, hey, can we do this? And I'd be like, yeah, come on the show.
I would like people to look forward to 2033 when we do the third and final episode in this Commodore trilogy. You know, hopefully not so much a Rise of Skywalker.
It's not gonna be that long. That's gonna be like 2027.
I reckon we probably get it done next year. Like that's a reasonable amount of time between episodes. All right. We're going to go out with the last track then, which is a remix of which track from Ghouls and Ghosts did you say it was again?
Oh, I think it was the remix of Level 5.
Level 5, okay. So that's a remix of Ghouls and Ghosts Level 5 called the Poltergeist Mix. And that is by the remixer Binster.
Super good. Super good all-time classic.
Very cool. So, yeah. Yeah, good night. Thank you very much for listening.